To guard, he didn't look like a man anymore. The shaggy head of a wolf poked out of the collar of his white shirt with a narrow red pinstripe. It looked around, pink tongue lolling, greenish yellow eyes sparkling. Arberg squealed some sort of approval and stuffed more odd lots into his pink pig snout. Patricia McCardle now had the smooth, sleek head of a whippet. The college dean and his wife were weasels, and the wife of the man from the electric company had become a frightened rabbit, pink eyes rolling behind thick glasses.
Bogard, no,
his mind moaned. He blinked again, and they were just people.
And one thing these protesters never remember to mention at their protest rallies is just this,
Ted the power man finished, looking around at them like a trial lawyer reaching the climax of his summation.
In 30 years of peaceful nuclear power development, there has never been one single fatality as the result of nuclear power in the United States of America.
He smiled modestly and tossed off the rest of his scotch.
I'm sure we'll all rest easier knowing that,
the man who looked like a college dean said. And now I think my wife and I...
Did you know that Marie Curie died of radiation poisoning?
Gardner asked conversationally. Heads turned.
Yeah. Leukemia induced by direct exposure to gamma rays. She was the first casualty along the death march with this guy's power plant at the end. She did a lot of research and recorded it all.
Gardner looked around the suddenly silent room.
Her notebooks are locked up in a vault,
he said.
A vault in Paris. It's lead-lined. The notebooks are whole but too radioactive to touch. As for who's died here, we don't really know. The AEC and the EPA keep a lid on it.
Patricia McCardle was frowning at him. With the dean temporarily forgotten, Arberg went back to scrounging along the denuded buffet table.
On the 5th of October, 1966,
Gardner said,
there was a partial nuclear meltdown of the Enrico Fermi breeder reactor in Michigan. Nothing happened,
Ted the power man said, and spread his hands to the assembled company as if to say,
you see, QED. No,
Gardner said.
Nothing did. God may know why, but my guess is no one else does. The chain reaction stopped on its own. No one knows why. One of the engineers the contractors called in took a look, smiled, and said, you guys almost lost Detroit. Then he fainted. Oh, but Mr. Gardner, that was...
Gardner held up a hand.
When you examine the cancer death stats for the areas surrounding every nuclear power facility in the country, you find anomalies, deaths that are way out of line with the norm. That is utterly untrue, and...
Let me finish, please.
I don't think the facts make any difference anymore, but let me finish anyway. Long before Chernobyl, the Russians had an accident at a reactor in a place called Kishtim. But Khrushchev was premier then, and the Soviets kept their lips a lot tighter. It looks like maybe they were storing used rods in a shallow ditch. Why not? As Madame Curie might have said, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Our best guess is that the core rods oxidized. Only, instead of creating ferrous oxide or rust, the way steel rods do, these rods rusted pure plutonium. It was like building a campfire next to a tank filled with LP gas, but they didn't know that. They assumed it would be all right. They assumed.
He could hear the rage filling his voice and was helpless to stop it.
They assumed. They played with the lives of living human beings as if they were, well, so many dolls, and guess what happened?
The room was silent. Patty's mouth was a frozen red slash. Her complexion was milky with rage.
It rained.
Gardner said.
It rained hard, and that started a chain reaction that caused an explosion. It was like the eruption of a mud volcano. Thousands were evacuated. Every pregnant woman was given an abortion. There was no choice involved. The Russian equivalent of a turnpike in the Kishtim area was closed for almost a year. Then, when word started to leak out that a very bad accident had happened on the edge of Siberia, the Russians opened the road again, but they put up some really hilarious signs. I've seen the photos. I don't read Russian, but I've asked 4 or 5 different people for a translation, and they all agree. It sounds like a bad ethnic joke. Imagine yourself driving along an American thruway, I-95 or I-70 maybe,
and coming up on a sign that says, "Please close all windows, turn off all ventilation accessories, and drive as fast as your car will go for the next 20 miles.
Bullshit, Ted the power man said loudly.
Photographs available under the Freedom of Information Act, Guard said. If this guy was only lying, maybe I could live with it, but he and the rest of the people like him are doing something worse. They're like salesmen telling the public that cigarettes not only don't cause lung cancer, they're full of vitamin C and keep you from having colds.
Are you implying 32 at Chernobyl we can verify?
Hell, maybe it is only 32. We've got photos taken by American doctors which suggest there must be well over 200 already, but say 32. It doesn't change what we've learned about high rad exposure. The deaths don't all come at once. That's what's so deceiving. The deaths come in three waves. First, the people who get fried in the accident. Second, the leukemia victims, mostly kids. Third, the most lethal wave. Cancer in adults 40 and over. So much cancer, you might as well go on and call it a plague. Skin cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, melanoma, and bone cancer are the most common. But you also got your intestinal cancer, your bladder cancer, your brain tumors, your...
Stop! Can't you please stop?
Ted's wife cried. Hysteria lent her voice a surprising power. I would if I could, dear, he said gently. I can't. In 1964, the AEC commissioned a study on a worst-case scenario if an American reactor one-fifth the size of Chernobyl blew. The results were so scary, the AEC buried the report. It suggested...
Shut up, Gardner, Patty said loudly. You're drunk.
He ignored her, fixing his eyes on the power man's wife.
It suggested that such an accident in a relatively rural area of the USA, the one they picked was mid-state Pennsylvania, where Three Mile Island is, by the way, would kill 45,000 folks, rad 70% of the state, and do $17 million worth of damage.
Holy fuck, someone cried. Are you shitting?
Nope,
Gardner said, never taking his eyes from the woman, who now seemed hypnotized with terror.
If you multiply by five, you get 225,000 dead and $85 million worth of damage.
He refilled his glass nonchalantly in the silent grave of the room, tipped it at Arberg, and drank two mouthfuls of straight vodka. Uncontaminated vodka, one hoped.
So, he finished. We're talking almost a quarter of a million people dead by the time the third wave dissipates. Around 2040.
He winked at Ted the power man, whose lips had pulled back from his teeth.
Be hard to get that many people even on a 767, wouldn't it?
Those figures came directly out of your butt, Ted the power man said angrily. Ted, the man's wife said nervously. She had gone dead pale except for tiny spots of red burning high up on her cheekbones.
You expect me to stand here and listen to that party-line rhetoric?
He asked, approaching Gardner until they were almost chest to chest.
Do you?
At Chernobyl, they killed the kids, Gardner said.
Don't you understand that? The ones 10 years old, the ones in utero. Most may still be alive, but they are dying right now while we stand here with our drinks in our hands. Some can't even read yet. Most will never kiss a girl in passion. Right now while we're standing here with our drinks in our hands.
They killed their children. He looked at Ted's wife, and now his voice began to shake and to rise slightly as if in a plea.
We know from Hiroshima, Nagasaki, from our own tests at Trinity and on Bikini. They killed their own children, do you dig what I'm saying? There are 9-year-olds in Pripyat who are going to die shitting out their own intestines. They killed the children.
Ted's wife took a step back, eyes wide behind her glasses, mouth twitching.
We'll acknowledge that Mr. Gardner is a fine poet, I think,
Ted the power man said, putting an arm around his wife and pulling her to his side again. It was like watching a cowboy rope a calf.
He's not very well informed about nuclear power, however. We really have no idea what may or may not have happened at Kishtim, and the Russian figures on the Chernobyl casualties are...
Cut the shit,
Gardner said.
You know what I'm talking about.
Bay State Electric has got all this stuff in its file, along with the elevated cancer rates in the areas surrounding American nuclear power facilities, the water contaminated by nuclear waste, the water in deep aquifers, the water people wash their clothes and their dishes and themselves in, the water they drink. You know, you and every other private, municipal, state, and federal power company in America. Stop it, Gardner, McArdle warned, stepping forward. She flashed an overbrilliant smile around the group. He's a little...
Ted, did you know?
Ted's wife asked suddenly.
Sure, I've got some stats, but...
He broke off. His jaw snapped shut so hard you could almost hear it. It wasn't much, but it was enough. Suddenly they knew, all of them, that he had omitted a good deal of scripture from his sermon. Gardner felt a moment of sour, unexpected triumph. There was a moment of awkward silence, and then quite deliberately, Ted's wife stepped away from him. He flushed. To guard, he looked like a man who has just whanged his thumb with a hammer.
Oh, we have all kinds of reports, he said. Most are nothing but a tissue of lies, Russian propaganda. People like this idiot are more than happy to swallow it, hook, line, and sinker. For all we know, Chernobyl may have been no accident at all, but an effort to keep us from...
Jesus. Next you'll be telling us the Earth is flat,
Gardner said.
Did you see the photographs of the army guys in radiation suits walking around a power plant half an hour's drive from Harrisburg? Do you know how they tried to plug one of the leaks there? They stuffed a basketball wrapped with friction tape into a busted waste pipe. It worked for a while, then the pressure spit it out and busted a hole right through the containment wall. You spout some pretty goddamn good propaganda.
Ted grinned savagely.
The Russians love people like you. Do they pay you, or do you do it for free?
Who sounds like an airport moony now?
Gardner asked, laughing a little. He took a step closer to Ted.
Nuclear reactors are better built than Jane Fonda, right? As far as I'm concerned, that's about the size of it, yes.
Please, the dean's wife said, distressed. We may discuss, but let's not shout, please. After all, we're college people.
Somebody better fucking shout about it,
Gardner shouted. She recoiled, blinking, and her husband stared at Gardner with eyes as bright as chips of ice. Stared as if he were marking guard forever. Guard supposed he was.
Would you shout if your house was on fire and you were the only one in your family to wake up in the middle of the night and realize what was happening? Or just kind of tiptoe around and whisper on account of you're a college person?
I just believe this has gone far and... Gardner dismissed her, turned to Mr. Bay State Electric, and winked at him confidentially.
Tell me, Ted, how close is your house located to this nifty new nuclear facility you guys are building?
I don't have to stand here and...
Not too close, huh? That's what I thought.
He looked at Mrs. Ted. She shrank away from him, clutching at her husband's arm. Guard thought,
what is it that she sees to make her shrink away from me like that? What? Exactly.
The voice of the booger-hooking comic book-reading deputy clanged back in dolorous answer.
Shat your wife, huh? Good fucking deal.
Are you planning to have children? He asked her gently.
If so, I would hope for your sake that you and your husband really are located a safe distance from the plant. They keep goofing, you know, like at Three Mile Island. Not long before they opened the sucker, someone discovered the plumbers had somehow hooked up a 3,000-gallon tank for liquid radioactive waste to the drinking fountains instead of the scut. In fact, they found out about a week before the place went online. You like it?
She was crying. She was crying, but he couldn't stop.
The guys investigating wrote in their report that hooking up radioactive waste coolant pipes to the ones feeding water to the drinking fountains was a generally inadvisable practice. If your hubby here invites you to take the company tour, I'd do the same thing they tell you to do in Mexico. Don't drink the water. And if your hubby invites you after you're pregnant, or after you even think you might be, tell him...
Gardner smiled, first at her, then at Ted.
Tell him you've got a headache,
he said. Shut up,
Ted said. His wife had begun to moan.
That's right, Arberg said. I really do think it's time for you to shut up, Mr. Gardner.
Guard looked at them, then at the rest of the partygoers who were staring at the tableau by the buffet, wide-eyed and silent, the young bartender among them.
Shut up,
Gardner yelled. Pain drove a gleaming spike into the left side of his head.
Yeah, shut up and let the goddamn house burn. You can bet these fucking slumlords will be around to collect the fire insurance later on, after the ashes cool and they rake out what's left of the bodies. Shut up! That's what all these guys want us to do. And if you don't shut up on your own, maybe you get shut up, like Karen Silkwood.
Quit it, Gardner, Patricia McArdle hissed. There were no sibilants in the words she spoke, making a hiss an impossibility, but she hissed just the same. He bent toward Ted's wife, whose sallow cheeks were now wet with tears.
Also, you might check the IDS rates. Infant death syndrome, that is. They go up in plant areas. Birth defects such as Down syndrome, mongoloidism, in other words, and blindness, and... I want you to get out of my house,
Arberg said.
You got potato chips on your chin,
Gardner said, and turned back to Mr. and Mrs. Baystate Electric. His voice was coming from deeper and deeper inside him. It was like listening to a voice coming out of a well, everything going critical, red lines showing up all over the control panel.
Ted here can lie about how vastly overrated it all was. Nothing but a little fire and a lot of headline fodder, and all of you can even believe him. But the fact is, what happened at the Chernobyl nuclear plant released more radioactive waste into the atmosphere of this planet than all the A-bombs set off above ground since Trinity. Chernobyl's hot. It's going to stay that way for a long time. How long? No one really knows, do they, Ted?
He tipped his glass toward Ted, and then looked around at the partygoers, all of them now standing silent and watching him, many looking just as dismayed as Mrs. Ted.
And it'll happen again. Maybe in Washington State. They were storing core rods in unlined ditches at the Hanford reactors just like they were at Gishtim. California, the next time there's a big quake? France? Poland? Or maybe right here in Massachusetts, if this fellow here has his way and the Iroquois plant goes online in the spring. Just let one guy pull the wrong switch at the wrong time, and the next time the Red Sox open at Fenway will be around 2075.
Patricia McArdle was as white as a wax candle, except for her eyes, which were spitting blue sparks that looked freshly dropped from an arc welder. Arbord had gone the other route. He was as red and dark as the bricks of his fine old family Back Bay home. Mrs. Ted was looking from Gardner to her husband and back again, as if they were a pair of dogs that might fight. Ted saw the look, felt her trying to back out of his encircling, imprisoning arm. Gardner supposed it was her reaction to what he had been saying, which provoked the final escalation. Ted had doubtless been instructed about how to handle hysterics like Gardner. The company taught their Teds to do that as routinely as the airlines taught stewardesses how to demonstrate the emergency oxygen system of the jets in which they flew. But it was late. Gardner's drunken but eloquent rebuttal had blown up like a pocket thunderstorm, and now his wife was acting as though he might be the butcher of Riga.
God, I get tired of you guys and your simpering. There you were tonight, reading your incoherent poems into a microphone that runs on electricity, having your braying voice amplified by speakers that run on electricity, using electric lights to see by. Where do you Luddites think that power comes from? The Wizard of Oz? Jesus!
It's late, McArdle said hurriedly. And we all...
Leukemia.
Gardner said, speaking directly to Ted's wide-eyed wife with dreadful confidentiality.
The children. The children are always the ones to go first after a meltdown. One good thing. If we lose Iroquois, it'll keep the Jimmy Fund busy.
Ted? She whimpered. He's wrong, isn't he? I mean... She was fumbling for a handkerchief or tissue in her purse and dropped it. There was the brittle sound of something breaking inside.
Stop it, Ted said to Gardner. We'll talk about it if you want, but stop deliberately upsetting my wife. I want her to be upset, Gardner said. He had embraced the darkness completely now. He belonged to it, and it belonged to him, and that was just fine.
There's so much she doesn't seem to know.
Stuff she ought to know, considering who she's married to and all. He turned the beautiful, wild grin on her. She looked into it without flinching this time, mesmerized like a doe in a pair of oncoming headlights.
Used core rods now. Do you know where they go when they're no more good in the pile? Did he tell you that the core rod fairy takes them? Not true. The power folks sort of squirrel them away. There are great big hot piles of core rods here, there, and everywhere, sitting in nasty pools of shallow water. They're really hot, ma'am, and they're going to stay that way for a long time.
Gardner, I want you out, Arbers said again. Ignoring him, Gardner went on, speaking to Mrs. Ted and Mrs. Ted only.
They're already losing track of some of those piles of used rods, did you know that? Like little kids who play all day and go to bed tired and wake up the next day and can't remember where they left their toys. And then there's the stuff that just goes poof, the ultimate mad bomber stuff. Enough plutonium has already disappeared to blow up the eastern seaboard of the United States, but I've got to have a mic to read my incoherent poems into. God forbid I should have to raise my...
Arbor grabbed him suddenly. The man was big and flabby, but quite powerful. Gardner's shirt pulled out of his pants. His glass tumbled out of his fingers and shattered on the floor. In a rolling, carrying voice, a voice which maybe only an indignant teacher who has spent many years in lecture halls could muster, Arberg announced to everyone present, "I'm throwing this bum out." This declaration was greeted by spontaneous applause. Not everyone in the room applauded, maybe not even half of them did. But the power guy's wife was crying hard now, pressing against her husband, no longer trying to get away. Until Arbor grabbed him, Gardner had been hulking over her, seeming to menace her. Gardner felt his feet skim over the floor, then leave it entirely. He caught a glimpse of Patricia McCardle, her mouth compressed, her eyes glaring, her hands smacking together in the furious approval she had refused to accord him earlier. He saw Ron Cummings standing in the library door, a monstrous drink in one hand, his arm around a pretty blonde girl, his hand pressed firmly against the side swell of her breast. Cummings looked concerned, but not exactly surprised. After all, it was only the argument in the Stone Country Bar and Grill continued to another night, wasn't it?
Are you going to let this swollen bag of shit just put you out on the doorstep like a stray cat?
Gardner decided he wasn't. He drove his left elbow backward as hard as he could. It slammed into Arberg's chest. Gardner thought that was what it would feel like to drive your elbow into a bowl of extremely firm jello. Arberg uttered a strangled cry and let go of Gardner, who turned, hands doubling into fists, ready to punch Arberg if Arberg tried to grab him again, tried to so much as touch him again. He rather hoped Argelbargel wanted to fight. But the beefy son of a whore showed no signs of wanting to fight. He had also lost interest in putting Gardner out. He was clutching his chest, like a hammy actor preparing to sing a bad aria. Most of the brick-like color had left his face, although flaring strips stood out on each cheek. Arberg's thick lips flexed into an O, slacked, flexed into an O again, slacked again.
"Heart,"
he wheezed.
"What heart?"
Gardner asked.
"You mean you have one?"
"Attack,"
Arberg wheezed.
"Heart attack bullshit,"
Gardner said.
"The only thing getting attacked is your sense of propriety, and you deserve it, you son of a bitch."
He brushed past Arberg, still standing frozen in his about-to-sing pose, both hands clutched to the left side of his chest where Gardner had connected with his elbow. The door between the dining room and the hallway had been crowded with people. They stepped back hurriedly as Gardner strode toward them and past them, heading for the front door. From behind him, a woman screamed, "Get out! Do you hear me? Get out, you bastard! Get out of here! I never want to see you again!" This shrewish, hysterical voice was so unlike Patricia McCardle's usual purr, steel claws buried somewhere inside pads of velvet, that Gardner stopped. He turned around and was rocked by an eye-watering roundhouse slap. Her face was ill with rage.
"I should have known better," she breathed. "You're nothing but a worthless, drunken lout, a contentious, obsessive, bullying, ugly human being. But I'll fix you. I'll do what you know I can."
"Why, Patty, I didn't know you cared," he said,
How sweet of you. I've been waiting to be fixed by you for years. Shall we go upstairs or give everyone a treat and do it on the rug? Ron Cummings, who had moved closer to the action, laughed. Patricia McArdle bared her teeth. Her hand flickered out again, this time connecting with Gardner's ear. She spoke in a voice which was low, but perfectly audible to everyone in the room.
I shouldn't have expected anything better from a man who would shoot his own wife.
Gardner looked around, saw Ron, and said, "Excuse me, would you?" and plucked the drink from Ron's hand. In a single, quick, smooth gesture, he hooked two fingers into the bodice of McArdle's little black dress. It was elastic and pulled out easily, and dumped the whiskey inside. "Cheers, dear," he said, and turned for the door. It was, he decided, the best exit line he could hope to manage under the circumstances. Arberg was still frozen, with his fists clutched to his chest, mouth flexing into an O and then relaxing.
"Heart,"
he wheezed again to Gardner. Gardner, or anyone who would listen to him. In the other room, Patricia McArdle was shrieking, "I'm all right! Don't touch me! Leave me alone! I'm all right!"
"Hey, you!"
Gardner turned toward the voice, and Ted's fist struck him high on one cheek. Gardner stumbled most of the way down the hall, clawing at the wall for balance. He struck the umbrella stand, knocked it over, then hit the front door hard enough to make the glass in the fanlight shiver. Ted was walking down the hall toward him like a gunfighter.
"My wife's in the bathroom having hysterics because of you, and if you don't get out of here right now, I'm going to beat you silly."
The blackness exploded like a rotted, gas-filled pocket of guts. Gardner seized one of the umbrellas. It was long, furled, and black, an English lord's umbrella, if there ever had been one. He ran toward Ted, toward this fellow who knew exactly what the stakes were, but who was going ahead anyway. Why not? There were 7 payments left on the Datsun Z and 18 on the house, so why not, right? Ted, who saw a 600% increase in leukemia merely as a fact which might upset his wife. Ted. Good old Ted. It was just lucky for good old Ted that it had been umbrellas instead of hunting rifles at the end of the hall. Ted stood looking at Gardner, eyes widening, jaw dropping. The look of flushed anger gave way to uncertainty and fear, the fear that comes when you decide you're dealing with an irrational being.
"Hey! Caramba, you asshole!"
Gardner screamed. He waggled the umbrella and then poked Ted, the power man, in the belly with it.
"Hey!"
Ted gasped, doubling over.
"Stop it!" "Andale, andale!"
Gardner yelled, now beginning to whack Ted with the umbrella. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The strap which held the umbrella furled against its handle came loose. The umbrella, still closed but now loose, slopped around the handle.
"Arriba, arriba!"
Ted was now too unnerved to think about renewing his attack, or to think about anything but escape. He turned and ran. Gardner chased him, cackling, beating the back of his head and the nape of his neck with the umbrella. He was laughing, but nothing was funny. His earlier sense of victory was leaving fast. What victory was there in getting the best of a man like this in an argument, even temporarily, or of making his wife cry, or of beating him with a closed umbrella? Would any of those things keep the Iroquois plant from going online next May? Would any of those things save what was left of his own miserable life, or kill those tapeworms inside him that kept digging and munching and growing, eating whatever was left inside that was sane?